Hey, Pacer fans, I'm Miles Turner, and here's the Sideline Guys podcast.
Hello and welcome into another edition of the Sideline Guys podcast. As always, I'm joined by TV host and sideline reporter Jeremiah Johnson. I'm Pat Boylan. We've had the last handful of weeks, JJ, to talk with a bunch of different players. Malcolm Brogdon, Doug McDermott, we talked with Victor Oladipo, Nazmi Toulon, TJ McConnell. Some enjoyable discussions. You get a kind of different perspective from each and every guy. Now that those have come to an end, we certainly hope those listening enjoyed listening to them as much as we enjoyed performing the interviews. But wondering if you had any takeaways from our chats with a handful of the team.
Well, in the days since, Pat, I've been asked a number of times what the guys had to say and what I generally thought about their demeanor and their mindset. And I think in general, everyone was so positive and just kind of focused on better days ahead and how they were continuing to work out. And we recorded these interviews via Zoom chat. And so we were actually able to see and interact with them. And I thought that made the discussion go, you know, quite a bit better than if we were just over the phone. And I noticed that all of them had a lot of enthusiasm, really, from a guy like Victor Oladipo and maybe Malcolm Brogdon, all the way down to Nazmi Toulon, who is a two-way player. And at the time, Nazmi Toulon was working out at the St. Vincent Center because he was rehabbing. But I did think that, you know, from 1 through 7, I think we talked to maybe 6 or 7 different guys. They all were very connected to their teammates during this unfortunate circumstance that we're dealing with. They were busy communicating. And while they had different workout facilities, some had basketball goals, some maybe had to work a little harder to find a court, I thought they were all staying in pretty good shape. We saw them. We didn't have to worry about, I don't think, if and when they were able to get back on the court, maybe gaining any weight, like maybe I'm a little bit worried about. But in general, they were pleasant conversations. We were able to talk basketball, but also to share a little bit of their personality. I do think they're evergreen. So in case you missed any of those, feel free to check back on Pacers Sound and listen to some of the conversations. But all of them, I felt like, Pat, had a good positive takeaway from the season through 65 games. I mean, no one really felt down about what had happened. Maybe there were some moments that they'd like to have back. Miles Turner was very honest about a slow start to the season and feeling better towards the second half of the season. But I thought, Pat, they were all pretty positive. I guess we should expect that.
No, I think all of that is accurate. It's how I took them as well. It was interesting just to get such a wide array of perspectives. You had rookies who are not from the U.S., like Goga Bitadze, who's here in Indianapolis, and what a whirlwind first season from him. You know, you had veterans like Victor Oladipo, not necessarily a grizzled veteran or anything, but a guy that's been around the league for some time. And you had, for example, Miles Turner, who's not in Indianapolis, who went home to Texas. I think the other takeaway I had is just how, in a lot of ways, they kind of turn into, you know, everyday people. They kind of morph back into everyday people. They're trying to binge Netflix. They're watching Tiger King. They're watching The Last Dance documentary, which, of course, is how we'll pivot here and has been on the last, I think, 5 weeks or so, the documentary about Michael Jordan, the 98 Bulls season, those seasons leading up to it. But, of course, there are plenty of Pacers ties into this documentary as well. We heard Michael Jordan say that he felt like that Pacers team perhaps gave them the toughest run of any of, you know, the teams that they took on in the playoffs during his time in the NBA once, you know, that Bulls reign really began past the Pistons. So let's bring on now somebody who was there for all of it, especially from a Pacers perspective, radio play-by-play announcer Mark Boyle. And I guess first thing I'm wondering from you, Mark, is, as you watch this documentary, you, of course, lived it from a Pacers perspective, which was in very close proximity to the Bulls as well. How much did you learn? How much of that was new? And what of those new things stood out to you?
Well, on a general level, Pat, not much of it was new. At the time, people in the league knew most of the stories, or at least the general tenor that there was conflict within the Chicago organization, that they were definitely, because of management's preferences, planning to go in a different direction regardless of what happened. So none of that was new. From the perspective of the viewer, I thought that the behind-the-scenes footage was pretty compelling. A lot of that we'd never seen before. The whole thing was interesting, and I think it's safe to say that probably in our experiences, the only cultural icon that could have pulled off 10 hours is Michael Jordan. I thought it was a bit long, but I'd be willing to bet there are people that didn't get enough of it. And you're talking 10 hours, which is a really, really long time. It was well done, really well done, I thought, and I think pretty enjoyable.
As you were watching some of these episodes, I think a lot of people that you weren't around the team as much as you were learning new things. I was, you know, 7, 8 years old or so during the 98 season. Jeremiah, you must have been somewhere around college, the college days for you. Mark, as you watched these Pacers teams and as we got closer to that 98 season and into the 98 season, how much of a belief did you have that the Pacers had a realistic opportunity of knocking off Jordan? Because you hear Reggie say, you know, I thought we were going to end Jordan's career. We've heard other Pacers players say that too. How much belief did you have that that was a possibility?
To be totally candid, I never thought it was going to happen. I thought it was possible. And as time went on, I thought it was more possible. And to clarify that a little bit, you have to put it into perspective. Remember, it was the first year after Larry Brown had left, and Brown's teams had done well, particularly early. But by the end, they were underachieving. They were not a playoff team. There was discontent. And then you bring back many of the same guys. There was no real reason to think there was anything to get excited about. And then they started, I think, 2-5 or 2-6, which isn't the end of the world, but it sort of was an extension of a disappointing 96-97 season. But then, as time went on, they started to win on a regular basis. You could see that they had a really good team. And by the time the playoffs started, I did expect that they would get to the conference finals. They had played that well. They were that impressive. And when I say I didn't think they would beat Chicago, I don't mean I thought it was impossible. Far from it. That Bulls team was not invincible, although it was very, very good. But I thought that Chicago, with the home court, would probably win the series. And the home team, as it turns out, won every game in that series. So we got to Game 7 tied at 3, and the Pacers had already lost all three games on the Chicago home floor. None of them were really close, although the point spreads weren't that dramatic. But Chicago had been the better team, clearly, in all three of those games in Chicago. And so I never really thought they were going to win. But then remember, in that seventh game, they got out in front like 20-7 or 20-8. And so they got a really good start. They were playing really well. And then you started to think, well, maybe. And then Chicago slowly but surely got back in and regained the lead. And then the Pacers took the lead. It came down to the final 4 minutes. So that's a long-winded answer to your question. But I would not have been shocked if they had won, but I never really expected them to win.
Mark, during the documentary, they kind of jumped around a little bit. They would tell stories from the 98 season and they would go back. And so I've got some questions about the 1998 playoff, but I want to go back to prior to that. And you think even prior to the first three titles, I thought it was really interesting to watch the video of the season when Michael Jordan was injured and then he came back and played against maybe the wishes of Jerry Krause, and Market Square Arena didn't have the same, you know, ferocity, or didn't have the same feeling as it did in those playoffs. So that was so early on. When did you notice from Michael Jordan that he was somebody special? Because people forget that he did not have playoff success for a number of years before he was able to break through.
Very true. And I didn't follow the NBA extremely closely until I got into it, which was 88. Now, I followed it previous to that because I was in sports broadcasting. I was doing talk shows. And so I had a basic knowledge of it. I knew how good Jordan was. But by the time I got to the league, and that was my only focus, and I saw him play often because they were in the same division as the Pacers, his reputation at the time was, well, he's terrific. No one can dispute that. He can pretty much do whatever he wants, but he's a selfish player, and he's not a winner. That was, on sort of a general level, his reputation at the early stages of his career. And then as Krause built the team around him, and they became a little bit better and a little bit better, and then they couldn't beat the Pistons, and then they did beat the Pistons, and then they started their championship run. By then, once he had proven himself through that first three championship run, the perception changed. And no one ever didn't think he was a terrific player, but there were serious questions early in his career as to whether or not he was good enough to be the anchor of a championship team. And obviously he was. They won six championships. But it's interesting, Jeremiah, think back to that time and realize that there was a time in his career when he was thought of more as a showman or a tremendous player and not really a serious guy that could win a championship because he wasn't willing to share the ball.
Because when you watch the documentary and his competitive nature, you forget about that. You think he's the ultimate winner. He's a champion. But much like LeBron early in his career was saddled with the will he ever win a championship, that is the way, you know, Michael Jordan was thought of as well. And I'm curious also, did you feel like the Pacers and Bulls were true rivals? And maybe at what point did you feel that way? Because they didn't have that playoff rivalry like the Pacers had with the Knicks, but they were in the same division. And obviously you're going to have a natural feeling with, you know, Bulls fans being in Indiana, maybe the northern part of the state. But the Pacers took a while to get to that success that Chicago had. Did you feel like maybe the Bulls were maybe the second rival to the Pacers outside of the Knicks?
No, and I think that's one of the major differences between the pro game and the college game. Chicago might be a little bit different because of the proximity geographically, but generally speaking, the college game and the rivalries that exist in it are there all the time. Purdue and Indiana will be rivals no matter what. If they both are awful in football, the anticipation of the old Oak and Bucket game is still there for alums, for students, because they're your rival no matter what. But in the pro game, the rivalries are determined by how good you are. And let's use specific real-life examples. Would you say the Pacers and Knicks are rivals anymore? No, because the Knicks are horrible. Are the Pacers and Pistons rivals anymore? No, not like they were in the early O's. So that Pacers-Knicks rivalry was far more intense because it had gone on over a number of years. Remember, the Knicks beat the Pacers in 93 and 94, and then the Pacers beat the Knicks in 95, and then they played for the conference championships in 99 and 2000. They played in the playoffs in 98, I believe. So every year, it seemed, the Knicks were there, and they were good, and the Pacers were getting good and eventually became good, and the game was much more physical then, so the rivalry became far more intense. I always thought, and if the players say differently, of course I would defer to them, but from the outside looking in as a non-participant, I always thought that that Pacer-Bull rivalry was primarily confined to 98, because that was the year both were good enough to win championships, and Chicago did, in fact, win the championship, and you could make the case that had the Pacers won that series, they would have been well positioned to win the championship. And in the pro game, that's where the rivalries are established. You have to be good enough to be able to keep the other guy from getting something he wants for it to be a real rivalry, which isn't true in the college game.
I want to go back to a little bit to the discussion you guys were just having about Michael Jordan, because I found the evolution and your description of his evolution to be kind of interesting. We can get into Mark, if we have time later in this podcast, greatest players of all time, where perhaps you have Jordan versus some of the previous greats and LeBron James and all of that. So as you know, he has these early days where we know he's talented, but aren't totally sure how much of a winner he is. At what point do you remember, if you do remember, the narrative changing with him to maybe this is not only the best player in the game, but maybe this is the best player ever? Or did that happen during his playing days?
Well, I think the best player in the game was during his playing days. He was almost without dispute the best player in the sport the entire time he was in it, at least in the earlier years, not so in the Wizard years, but in the Chicago years, maybe not at the very beginning as a rookie, but shortly thereafter, his talent was so transcendent that he was regarded, I think, as the sport's ultimate talent almost his entire Chicago career. And to be regarded as an all-time great, you have to have played for a while. You have to have had some success. And I think, to be really fair, you have to be retired. In other words, we have to be able to consider the entire body of work before we can say this player or that player or whomever. But he was always regarded as almost peerless. And see, that's the thing that strikes me about Jordan, about James in his prime, about players of that ilk. They're almost always considered peerless. Now, there are other tremendous players in the sport, but if you think back to the Jordan years, Pat, who was regarded as his contemporary? In other words, when the conversation said, well, who's the best player in the NBA? Was it ever Jordan and X, at least after the early years? No, it was always, well, there's Jordan, and then there's these other guys. The same as during James' prime, there was James, and then there's these other guys. And so those kinds of players, it seemed, come along so rarely. And part of it's contextual, part of it's timing. If, for example, Jordan had James had run and James had run parallel careers, then they might have been in the conversation by themselves, similar to the way Johnson and Bird were back in the earlier era. So part of it's timing, part of it is skill, part of it is accomplishment. But I don't recall a time, at least as I said earlier, since I got into the league in 88, where Jordan wasn't considered the best player. Even at the end, that last championship, he may not have been the player he was in 94 or 95. He was a little fatigued, a little bit beaten down. But I still think, at least my recollection tells me, that he was still considered the best player in the game. And then when he came back and played for the Wizards, that was different. But almost his entire Chicago run, he was regarded as the finest player in the NBA.
So when you start in your position in 1988, you have the unique perspective of entering the league in the pre-internet, mostly pre-computer era, and now experiencing it now where every single, you know, moment is captured in a social media Twitter sphere. As I was rewatching this documentary, and I was a 1990s baby, so I was young during it, I was really amazed just how much drama surrounded this team, and maybe of equal amazement how they were able to still win despite it. You had, you know, Dennis Rodman going off into the WWE and missing a practice during the finals. You had Scottie Pippen in the year that Jordan was out refusing to make a key inbound pass. And that's just a couple in a long, long list. How much do you remember that circus being a side story to them? And is it possible to imagine what that would be like in today's era of social media?
Let's take the latter part of that first. Assuming everything had happened the same, it's not possible for me to imagine what a chaotic nightmare it would have been for the people involved. On the other hand, had they known there was such scrutiny, maybe they would have handled themselves differently. See what I'm saying here? We all get away with what we can get away with. And if you knew that your every move was being chronicled in social media, maybe you would have handled yourself differently. Maybe not. It's not unprecedented either for teams to quarrel and win championships. I'm older than both of you, and I think back to when I was a young person following sports as a junior high student along that era of my life. I remember the Oakland Athletics won 3 straight championships and were fighting in the clubhouse all the time. So it's not without precedent, although it obviously makes things far more challenging and far more difficult. Something that was never explored in the documentary, and I don't know that it could have been. It would be an odd dynamic. I would have really been interested in knowing, wouldn't you guys have been, what the rest of the team thought about the unlimited access of those cameras. If I were Jordan's teammate, that would have bothered me. I would consider the clubhouse, the locker room, a place where I can go and be private with my guys, with our brotherhood, and not be bothered by cameras and people that want to chronicle every minute. I never heard anything that indicated anybody was upset about it, and maybe they weren't. But how do you guys feel about that? Would you have liked cameras in there following your every move? It would have bothered me as a teammate.
Yeah, I think that it was interesting because you're watching it, you didn't get the feeling that anybody was bothered by it. Even more surprising, Michael Jordan accepted and embraced all of the media. Now, there were times maybe he didn't want to talk that much, but I think that even compared to the stars of today, he handled it better than many would have. Now, we know, Kobe Bryant's final year, there were cameras all around, and maybe there will be another documentary come out alongside of that. And maybe some of the Lakers of that season didn't really enjoy that too much because they were not winning. But I thought they handled it pretty well. And I guess the one thing I wanted to ask both of you, did you like the presentation? Mark had already said maybe it was a little bit too long. Pat, you're probably learning more about that team in that era because you're younger, but the way the documentary was presented, were you like thumbs up 10 out of 10, Pat? Did you have any critique? And then I'm curious, Mark, after Pat answers, how you would have changed it or done it differently, because I do think that's a valid point that you just brought up.
No, personally, especially in this quarantine era, for me, this thing could have kept going even longer just because there's really nothing else to do, nothing to watch. And I, you know, find the subject matter really interesting. Although from a pure impact per episode metric, I think, you know, it probably shouldn't have gone any longer than it did. But the back and forth to me was an interesting dynamic. I kind of like when, whether it's a book that does that or a movie that kind of goes back and forth, not really present to past because it's all past, but you kind of got almost a feeling of that present to past kind of motif that sometimes you'll see in books. I thought it was well done going back and forth. Although I, you know, will admit at times, if you weren't watching it really closely, it could be easy to get a little bit confused. So I've heard some feedback. The one maybe tough aspect of this is you sense that there's no way to fix this, but there's no possible way in a 10 episode series to talk to everybody that's necessary and to get the feeling of everyone that's necessary. I saw something today, you know, that Scottie Pippen wasn't thrilled with how it turned out. You can imagine that Jerry Krause was probably would not have been thrilled with how all of it turned out. But, you know, there's only so much that you can do. In general, I thought it was very, very well done, informative, interesting, compelling. And I thought they did a nice job with the last couple episodes chronicling those Pacers series. I've heard some Pacers fans say I would have liked to see more into that series. And personally, so would I have. But that, you know, that wasn't the major theme of those final couple episodes. It clearly was the last game against the last series against Utah and those couple finals against Utah. But I found the series as a whole very compelling and very well done.
I agree with all of that. And you may know the answer to this. I don't, because I did watch all of it. But I didn't really follow the articles that were written about it, the reaction. I didn't stay with ESPN afterwards to watch their post-game shows and all of that. So maybe this was addressed. But it seemed to me that since they had access to virtually everybody, I would have been interested in hearing what Karl Malone had to say. I would have been interested in hearing what Clyde Drexler had to say during that Portland series. We didn't hear either of those guys, at least not to my recollection. And maybe they refused to speak. That I don't know. But if that was an oversight, if you're going to do 10 hours, it seems to me like you should probably cover every inch of it. And that's a nitpick. It didn't make it less enjoyable for me. Did you guys know if they approached Malone and Drexler and maybe one or two others that I'm not thinking about and those guys just refused to participate?
I'm not 100%, but I did think I heard something in the last day or two that Malone and Bryant Russell were the ones that did not accept an invitation. So the Jazz may be still a little bit upset. But I found something today that was reported out of Salt Lake City. Apparently, someone who used to be an assistant manager at a Pizza Hut is disputing the pizza claim. So I'm interested to see maybe the 11th edition or maybe part 11 can be tying up all the loose ends and we can get the real story about that.
You know
pizza,
what?
Because I found that fascinating.
You know what, Jeremiah? That just reinforces something we all learned as kids from our parents. Don't lie. And especially today, if you're a public figure in the social media era, if you lie, you're going to get busted. It's just going to happen.
Right.
And I did see that same article, and it struck me as amusing for two reasons. Number one, it's amusing on its own. And number two, is it not amusing that it's even a story? Who really cares when you get right down to it?
I just had the image of five people standing at the door with a pizza. Like, did that really happen?
And when they told that story, didn't that seem a little like, okay, really? Because I found myself thinking, are you sure there were five people there? And now it turns out maybe there weren't.
Well, it's possible that there were multiple people there and that there was a pizza delivered. And who knows how much truth there is to the story. The takeaway that I had the most from it was it almost seemed like Michael was trying to convince you of something in the way that he described it. And maybe he was the only one that ate the pizza. It's very possible. But he kept like kind of hammering that point. I was the only one that ate the pizza. It was only me that had the pizza, because obviously if anybody else had it, they would have likely gotten food poisoning too. But you do wonder how many truths there are. And I guess it kind of goes back to, in some ways, you're getting one side of the story from a lot of aspects. You don't have Malone, you don't have Drexler. You had, you know, some of those Pacers players' perspectives. I thought they did a nice job there in general, but you still don't have, no matter what, you don't have the full side of the story, whether it's, you know, something small like this pizza or whether it's a couple of finals runs against the Jazz.
A couple of things I did want to get Mark's perspective of what he remembers at the time. So one of my vivid memories of the mid-90s, I happened to be in Florida on a summer vacation my junior year of high school, and it happened to be when Michael Jordan was playing for the Birmingham Barons. And so we were down there, obviously, to go to the Disney parks and whatnot, but just happened to look in the newspaper and say, well, guess who's playing the Orlando Rays while we're in Orlando? The Birmingham Barons. So we went and saw, you know, a minor league baseball game. So I kind of had that up close and personal image of what Michael Jordan playing baseball was all about. Did you think, though, there was a feeling in the league that Michael Jordan would come back, or were you at all monitoring how he was progressing in his dream of playing Major League Baseball? And I guess the follow-up to that, which it's not really related, but do you think the Pacers, did they feel like with the Bulls and Jordan out of the mix, at least for a season and a half, it opened the door a little bit, even though they had yet to really, you know, experience success during those first three title years? I'm wondering if there was a feeling around the league like, now it's our turn.
It's hard to say, Jeremiah, because generally speaking, you're only really in tune with the perspective around the team you're involved with. And the first year Jordan was out was Larry Brown's first year with the Pacers. And the Pacers, remember, up until that point, had never won a playoff series, never mind gotten to the conference finals or contended for a championship. So I think at least at the beginning of that season, there was no reason here to think that Jordan's absence was an opportunity. Now, by the time you got to the end of the season, it was a different story. And then the next off season, as you looked forward to 94-95, you really looked at it as an opportunity. And in both of those years, the Pacers got to the conference finals and lost in seven games. So opportunity loss for them, opportunity loss for the Magic, and opportunity loss for the Knicks, but not opportunity loss for the Rockets, who won both of those championships. And the other thing about Jordan's baseball that I think, no need for them to have covered this in great depth in the documentary, but just in general, and I remember thinking this at the time, anybody that thinks he failed in baseball has no idea how hard it is. He hit 200 at the age of, what was he, 31 or whatever he was. He hadn't played baseball since high school. Now, 200 for a professional baseball player is not good. It's going to get you released. But to hit 200 at double A, that to me is a spectacular success. And I was always amazed at how people thought he failed. I thought he succeeded. I thought he did really, really well.
Well, in sports too, that seemingly have such little crossover. Sometimes you'll see quarterbacks that are also pitchers, or you know, running backs, or wide receivers perhaps that are also basketball players. The first name that comes to my head is Gary Harrison. How good of a receiver he was.
Yeah, but Pat, those are relatively concurrent. They're doing it at the same time. This guy was doing it in his 30s.
And
wasn't he right about 30 when he went to baseball?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and he hadn't played in over a decade. That to me is amazing.
And besides, you know, the obvious hand-eye coordination that comes with every sport, you're talking about two very polar opposite sports. Almost nothing that makes you great in basketball, not almost nothing, but very few things that make you great in basketball directly translate to hitting a baseball, at least I think.
Yeah, that's all hand-eye coordination. Yeah. Danny Ainge, but again, concurrent. He was playing minor league baseball right out of BYU, wasn't he? Or maybe when he was in BYU, I can't remember.
No, it was while he was still in college, yeah.
So that's not to denigrate him. He made it to the big leagues and the NBA, which is another great feat. What I'm getting at is this. I think the judgment of Jordan's baseball career was very incomplete and very superficial because it only looked at the numbers. Is hitting 200 in double-A baseball going to get you to the next level? No, not generally. But to do it in the context that he did it, I thought was really amazing. Now, I'm not going to go overboard like some of his teammates did in interviews I've seen since, although I'm not going to dismiss them either. They have a better knowledge of the game than I do. I don't know that that meant he was getting to the big leagues, like some of them say. But he was getting better. He was getting better. The only reason I doubt it is because he was getting better at an age where your physical skills generally start to decline, at least in terms of competing at an elite level. So I don't know if he would have gotten to the big leagues, but in my opinion, that doesn't diminish what he did at the AA level, which I thought was really, really impressive.
No, I think that's interesting enough perspective, because I think nobody really discusses the positive of that. I think a lot of people look at it, maybe not quite as a joke, but, you know, almost a blip on the radar of otherwise was, you know, a stupendous career. And I think that's probably not looking at it in the correct lens. Before we close this, I want to kind of take this back to some Pacers discussion for a minute. Have you had the chance, Mark, to maybe look back at some of those Pacers teams in the 90s, the 2000s finals team, maybe 2004 as well, maybe even the ones from the 2010s? Have you decided upon a Pacers team that you think was the best?
The best team, I thought, in the time I've been here, was the 98 team. Fit together perfectly, totally professional, totally committed, willing to sacrifice, just exactly what you would want a championship caliber team to be. But if you were to force me to pick one and say, boy, this is the team that you would like to represent you every year if you could, that 98 team, I think, is hard to beat.
When you see Jordan, go ahead, JJ.
Do you remember, I thought it was fascinating to watch that one clip of Larry Bird and Michael Jordan after the game in 98. Does anything stand out to you? And it's okay if it doesn't, but in the aftermath, not maybe the bus ride, or just kind of when that season or that run came to an end, what it was like that night?
Not really. And you could correct me if I'm wrong. My recollection is that it was a day game on a Sunday. And we always come right back after games. And so I'm sure we were home relatively early that same evening. It's a very short flight. I know guys were disappointed. I've heard some of them mention about tears in the locker room. I don't always go in the locker rooms after games. And I don't remember being in that one. So I may not have the same recollection as somebody who did, but I know that team. When I say I don't think they were better than the Bulls, I will guarantee you that they thought they were better than the Bulls. And I know they were crushed. That I do know, because they really felt they were, and they were good enough to win. They were. They almost did. And so to be that close, and especially when you've had so many opportunities that you had fallen short in. Remember, they'd been in the playoffs every year at that time since 90. And they'd lost in the first round in 90, 91, 92, and 93. And then they lost in the conference finals in 94 and 95. I stand corrected. They weren't in the playoffs every year. The next year, they lost to Atlanta in the first round. That was the year Reggie was injured right before the playoffs. And then in 97, they didn't make it, Larry Brown's last year. So they didn't make it every year, but they were in it most every year, and they were progressively getting better, and they'd been so close. They'd lost two game sevens in the conference finals, and now they weren't all here for that. Chris Mullin was with the Warriors during that time, for example, and others were not around. They were on other teams or not yet in the league, but several of them had been around long enough to experience some of this stuff, and I know they were crushed, because what you don't understand when you're really young and coming up, if you're lucky enough to be on a really good team and you're 22 years old, it's hard to understand that, boy, this might be my only chance. Well, it turned out it wasn't their only chance, but it was their best chance, at least to that point. They did get to the finals in 2000 after losing again in 99. But they really thought they had a terrific team, and they did have a terrific team, and I know they were just crushed.
Speaking of the timing aspect that you alluded to, you know, some of the very best Pacers teams have coincided with Michael Jordan or LeBron James. And you noted that the Pacers and Bulls never were really a rivalry. And it was really only that 98 season. We heard Jordan say that that Pacers team probably gave them the toughest battle that they had. And we've seen just the countless tight games against LeBron James. The Pacers have taken James to 7 games twice, to 6 games a couple of other times. Do you see parallels in the different eras, even if maybe the Pacers in the 2010s weren't quite as good as the 1990s, of having teams that really had a chance to compete but ran into maybe the top two, certainly two of the top five players of all time?
Well, there are certainly parallels. You know, you're losing to Jordan in 98, and then you're getting beaten by James twice in later years. The Knicks teams had Ewing, and although he's not in the class of Jordan and James, he's in that next level below. They beat the Pacers multiple times. That terrific Detroit team with an ensemble of really good players, Billups, Hamilton, and those guys took the Pacers out a couple of times, once in the conference finals. And the whole thing illustrates something to me that is really, I think, a secret, not literally, but on some level, outside of Indianapolis, and it's this. I alluded earlier to the 93-94 season when Brown came and the Pacers won a playoff series for the first time. That's 26 years, including this season. And the Pacers have been to the Eastern Conference Finals 8 times over that period of time. And that's more than any other team in the East. They've been to the NBA Finals once. So their record in the Conference Finals is not good, and they've never won a championship. And because of that, they've been overlooked. But you could make the case that over that 26-year period, or 25-plus, if you don't want to count this season concluded yet, that they have been, by any measure, a top 10 team in the NBA, and maybe higher than that. But because they've never won, and because they're in a small market, and they've never had a superstar, and that's a subjective term. By superstar, I mean a Jordan, a James, a Bryant. They've never had that kind of a guy. They've rarely had a lottery pick. Free agents don't come here. And if you think of all of those things and put them together, it's amazing to me what they've accomplished here. It's a model franchise. It's been extraordinarily well run. And people outside of Indianapolis don't know that. And sometimes, guys, I wonder if the fans here even appreciate that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's something I wanted to hit on before we closed here, because the Bulls had one of the greatest dynasties of all time, and maybe what would have been the greatest had Jordan either played longer or not taken that stint away from the game. And I don't know if the show meant this, but it kind of at least gave this tone off. Since Jordan has left, and they discussed not getting a chance to go for that 7th championship, and it was, you know, I think if you were born maybe in 2000, it'd be really hard to imagine the idea of breaking that team up, because nowadays, when teams break up, it's typically a player's doing. The Bulls had a couple of pretty good teams in, you know, the early 2010s, but did you see at the end of the documentary, it was, you know, pretty slight, but just a note that, and then the Bulls began to rebuild in 1999 or whatever it was. And it almost made it seem like it was saying a quick jab at, and here we are in 2020 and things aren't that different. Was that just me, or did you guys kind of feel like that was kind of a, maybe a hidden meaning from the way they displayed that?
Well, it was almost like they could have continued. Yeah.
Yeah. And they've never come close since. There is one little thing that I would take issue with, not with the documentary itself, but the angst that followed that season, where the general consensus in the media and certainly with the Chicago fans was that if our dynasty is to end, it should be ended by another team and not by guys in suits. Well, the guys in suits own the team and pay for everything. And if they want to end it, then that's their choice. I get that that's not fair to the fans, but you know what? Somebody's got to make those decisions. And don't forget, the Boston Celtics went with their big three until the end, until it was too late, and then they were miserable for years and years after that. There's more than one way to play a situation. Now, they played it clumsily, obviously. For your general manager to say, if the coach goes 82-0, he's not coming back, seems a little short-sighted to me. But still, the guys in the suits get to decide how they want to run things, and that's one of the reasons they're the guys in the suits. They've got the green. They get to do whatever they want. That's why they're the owners, and you are the fans, and we are the media. It's not our choice to make. And I'm amazed that almost 100% of everybody thinks that that's not ownership's choice. Why do they think that?
Good question. I found something interesting. I did watch the post game show or whatever you want to call it with Scott Van Pelt right after the final episode. They interviewed the director or the producer of the show, and he said, if there's one thing that wasn't taken in the way you thought it would be, what was it? And he said that by no means did they mean to cast Krause as the villain. In fact, he thought that early on, the producer thought that by showing how he was treated, that people would almost sympathize with Jerry Krause, that they would feel like he was bullied. And he felt like the producer that's not the tone that was taken. And you've seen some people talk about, you know, after this has ended, you know, look, Jerry Krause took some hits in the beginning. You know, he was at least part of the decision making of what ended it. But he really only came there with, you know, Michael Jordan in hand, which, of course, is a massive piece to have. He built everything else around that. What were your impressions of Jerry Krause, I guess, and did you feel like he was portrayed accurately?
Well, I thought the two guys that came off looking bad were Krause and Scottie Pippen.
Yeah, me too.
Krause had no means with which to defend himself. He's passed away. Pippen, I feel no sympathy for. Pippen looked bad because of Pippen. For you to say, for example, well, that time I didn't go into the game in the playoffs was probably not my proudest moment, but I probably wouldn't do it any differently. Why would you think people don't think you're a buffoon? I understand, and Jeremiah alluded to this earlier, I understand that he's not pleased with the way he was depicted. Well, that's on him. That's his own voice saying that. On the other hand, I thought Steve Kerr came off looking great. And on some kind of an indefinable level, even though Jordan came off as a bit of a bully and maybe at least earlier in his career an intolerant teammate and maybe difficult to get along with and maybe mean-spirited, none of which, by the way, are admirable traits, at least for me, and I'm wondering if you guys feel the same, I actually came away liking him more because he became, and I say this as somebody who covered the game and had seen him play many, many times, but to my recollection, I've never spoken to him, so I don't know him. And I came away with a more fleshed out view of the guy. He became almost more human to me. And even though some of those traits are not desirable, I actually ended up liking him better than this iconic mythic figure the media has turned him into.
Oh, 100%. I mean, he's not the commercial, I want to be like Mike. I mean, sometimes that's what people think about him that weren't around then, but he's a real person and he has weaknesses and, you know, he has flaws just like everyone else does. And I did find myself appreciating that. And it was a little bit of a one-sided, obviously, documentary. I mean, it's Jordan that's controlling it and there were things that weren't addressed that he maybe didn't want to, but I didn't. You know what you're getting when you're watching it. I'm curious, Mark, though, as my final thought to you, I know in the summers, you often like to pick up hobbies and different things that you, whether it's a new skill like the coffee shop or the minor league baseball, and you haven't had the opportunity to do whatever you've wanted over the last 2 months. But is there anything that you've done to keep yourself busy that you maybe didn't expect during this time that we've been away from the Pacers?
Well, I'm not generally much of a TV viewer, but I have been binge watching some stuff that I've enjoyed. So that's maybe a bit of a departure. I had planned, and I'm still going to pursue this at some point, assuming we ever get back to normal, which I'm hoping happens sooner rather than later. The next time I have an extended time off in an off season, I was going to do it this summer, but I had made plans to do some training and spend some time being a 911 operator. Now think about this.
Wow.
What if you have an emergency and you dial 911 and MJB's on the other end? Are you thinking, you know what, maybe I should have handled this myself?
Maybe they might think they dialed the wrong number.
Yeah, that's probably more the case.
Exactly. So that's something that might happen at some point in time, though.
Well, I'm hoping so. You know, we had talked about it, and one of our security guys, John Ball, had asked me if I was interested, and I had never even considered it. I said, you think I can do that? He said, yeah, you'll have to take some training, I think, but I'll check on it. He did, and they said they would be interested. But then this happened.
Your calming voice.
We were never able to pursue it. So that's something I'd like to do. But I, you know, for now, I think I'm like both of you guys and virtually everybody else. We are very limited in what we can do. And I have tried to adhere to the guidelines. Generally, I leave the house to go to the grocery store two or three times a week. I'll get takeout a couple of times a week. But other than that, I'm in the house. And I'm doing a lot of reading and binge watching and trying to enjoy the time off. And here's something I found about myself. As you know, I'm a bit of a loner anyway. I'm perfectly fine sitting here all by myself for days on end. However, there's something a little bit different when you're told you have to. It just rubs you the wrong way.
I feel exactly the same way. We've also appreciated your home court hype calls. Is there one particular outlandish or unusual call that a fan submitted that you had to provide play-by-play for?
Well, I've enjoyed doing them, and I know I can speak for Chris Denary. He's done some too, and they've turned out really well. I would say this, you know, Wheat Hotchkiss, who sends me the videos, sends us the stuff, and then I look at it, and then I'm thinking, okay, that'll be easy. Or are you kidding me? What am I supposed to do with this? He sent me one about a week and a half ago. And by the way, one of my favorite ones that I did was with his 10-month-old daughter, because I was able to get a Wheat Hotchkiss slam in there while I was doing it, which I kind of enjoyed. But he sent me one with this guy, and it lasted over a minute. He's in his yard with a can of beer and a dog, and he's drinking the beer in one gulp, and it's in slow motion. So there's very little action going on. There's nothing really to talk about. And when I saw that video, I thought, well, I could do this, but for over a minute? And on some real weird level, it was a stimulating challenge, and I really enjoyed it.
I think they've turned out terrific. And for those who don't know what Mark is referencing, Wheat has a, I believe, 10-month-old
dog. Daughter. Yep.
Mark made the comment that she's got genetics at her disadvantage because Wheat didn't actually walk until he was 10 years old. So, but see, we should have known sending that to you versus Denary that he was setting himself up for that.
Well, we all know this. Chris is a little more traditional than I am. And that said, have you seen the one that he did with those two people doing the dishes? It's really good. It's really good. I was impressed.
I think Chris is a little more traditional than you might have been.
Yeah, all right. Maybe a lot more traditional. That said, though, I looked at the one that he, and he's done many, and he's done well with all of them, but the one that stood out for me was the one, it was some kitchen, and these two people were doing the dishes, and boy, he was really good. I was very impressed.
I think both of you have done a nice job with them, so well done to both of you.
Well, thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I echo those sentiments, and it was good talking with you on this podcast. I guess I have a little – I'm glad to revisit The Last Dance and the Michael Jordan era, but I'm kind of ready to move on. Are you just – you know, we've had this for the last 5 weeks. Pat said he could watch it for another 5 weeks. I'm ready for something new, and I appreciate you, though, helping us kind of revisit it one last time here on the sideline, guys.
It was fun, and I'm not tired of it, because until 5 weeks ago, it was rarely ever mentioned. It wasn't one of those things that people talked about, like the Pacer-Knicks series and Reggie with 8 points in 8 seconds, and it was there, and we all remembered it, but it wasn't dissected like it was. So I've enjoyed that, but I think I can speak for everybody when I say, as much fun as that was and as much as I enjoyed it, I'd be really excited to get back to live games that we don't know the outcomes of.
Jeremiah, I wanted to preface that by saying I was comparing that to this Sunday when there will be nothing on. I wasn't comparing that to, like, the Eastern Conference.
No, oh, yeah. We should. For sure, yeah.
Right now, I would, you know, in fact, I would love to sit down and watch – you know, the Atlanta Hawks take on the Memphis Grizzlies right now over that documentary in the regular season. I would much rather do that. You know, really quick to close the book on Jordan, you guys were discussing just how he came across. And, you know, the comparisons here might be a little strong or a little far-fetched. But I think part of the reason why you're right, Mark, is because I think those fans, whether it's of the Bulls or whether it's of the Pacers, you want your best player to want it more than anything. And while Reggie never got there, and while Reggie, I'm sure, went about it in very different ways, the one thing that does seem to be similar about the two is they wanted to win at all costs. They weren't afraid of anybody. And in Reggie's case, there were actually better players, you know, than him on the floor, especially when he took on Jordan and the Bulls, and that they led by example. They didn't talk the talk and then not show up. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Reggie was, you know, somebody that was out there at the beginning of practice all the way through the end, the last one getting up shots. And to me, as a fan, that's what you want your best player to be like. And I think that is what people probably take away from Jordan in that documentary more than anything.
Yeah, he was a really, really hard worker, dedicated to getting better. If he never opened his mouth and you were one of his teammates, you could learn a lot just from watching the way he went about his job. And one of the things about a guy like that, Pat, is this. If you are coming into the league or joining a new team and you see that the best player is the hardest worker, well, then who are you not to put in the effort? And that's the one thing that I have found to be a bit misleading, because I think it's really a little bit too simplistic. And this isn't to denigrate Jordan. Everybody says the most competitive guy of all time, the most ruthless competitor that ever lived. Well, just because somebody doesn't show their competitive spirit in a way that we can all identify with doesn't mean they're not as competitive as the next guy. And I'm not denigrating Jordan at all. I'm sure he's everything they said he was, but I can assure you, because I've seen guys like this, there are guys that are every bit as competitive and cutthroat as he is. They just don't show it the same way.
The only other thing I wanted to hit on with the 1998 Pacers was this. What was your reaction when you saw the result of the decision of everybody to shave their heads?
Oh, well, that wasn't the only year they did that. I think that started maybe my memory's faulty, but I thought they did it earlier in the Knicks series also. Do you remember that?
I don't off the top of my head, but I'm not 100% sure.
Well, maybe they didn't. Go back and look at that team picture and tell me, yeah, for example, tell me that, oh, just pick a random guy. Tell me that Rick Smith looks better than Jalen Rose. Tell me that Fred Hoiberg is going to be on in the next movie as a star. I mean, those guys did not look good. And then you throw in the black socks. Remember the black socks?
Yeah.
Oh, they look like old guys headed for a shuffleboard game.
See, I would watch a one-episode documentary on just shaving of the heads. Like, there's no way Rick Smith really wanted to do that, right?
I'm sure not. In fact, no. didn't he say he was reluctant? Mark Monteith wrote a good piece about this on Pacers.com not too many days ago. And I think Rick mentioned in there that he wasn't all that enthused about it. There's a terrific picture on Twitter, and I can't remember who posted it, but it's of our old equipment guy, Joe Cotato, shaving Fred's head. You can find it if you look for it. And I don't remember this, but in Mark's piece, Fred said he had shaved his head down to a crew cut, and then when he got there, he decided, well, I better finish it. And then he couldn't remember who shaved his head. It turned out it was Joe Cotato.
Rick, then we can put to bed the long rumor that after seeing those guys shave their heads in 98, you decided to follow suit.
No, I'll give you the very brief version of mine. My theory on hair is the same as lawns. If your lawn looks bad, you don't let the grass grow longer. You get rid of it. And the same with hair. And my dad had really bad hair. And when I saw him go and he wore a bad hair piece for a minute, and I thought, you know what? When mine goes, that's it. I'm getting rid of it. You guys weren't around. Well, Pat, you weren't. Jeremiah might have been around when I grew my lockout hair. Was that 2011?
2011. Yeah.
The lockout lasted from July 1 until right around Christmas. So I didn't shave my head for whatever that was, 5 months. I had hair down to my shoulders with a receding hairline and a bald spot in the back. I looked like a deranged serial killer.
Well, I'll counter, though. You said your hair doesn't look good grown out, and I've got to find this, and I may have shared this with you. I have a page that's out of an old Pacers program from the 80s, and it's
it looked good when I was young, Jeremiah. I had a solid lid back in the day.
It just deteriorated like a bad lawn?
like a bad lawn. I shave my head now, and I've been doing it for, I don't even know, maybe at least 12 or 13 years.
The night everything came to a halt a couple of months ago, you and I went out for a couple of drinks, and I would be lying if in the top 10 of things I was wondering was if you were bringing back that version of the lockout here. Pandemic here, yeah. I don't know what you call it. But,
well, had I known that we would still be sitting here in the middle of May, I might have. But I was hoping for a quicker resolution.
Let's just keep shaving it, and we hope we can see you working again soon.
Yeah, I'm on board with that. That would work for me.
Okay.
He's Mark Boyle.
I think we have to end it right here. Yeah.
I think we've about touched on everything. But Mark, thank you for your time. We appreciate your perspective. And I know a lot of fans enjoyed going down memory lane these past 5 weeks on Sunday. And hopefully we allowed them to do that a little bit more here today.
I enjoyed it tremendously, although I must admit my ego is a bit shaken by the fact that you chose Victor, Malcolm, and others before me.
Well, you've got your own podcast, right? I mean, we need to mention your conversations with Slick Leonard. I mean, that's a big hit as well.
Yeah, those are ongoing. We're doing those, and they show up every Thursday. Pat sends out the links, and we're having a lot of fun with those.
We appreciate that.
Good point, Jeremiah. Any good show promotes, you know, the other shows on the same channel. So if you haven't listened to any of those, Mark Boyle and Slick Leonard, they talk for less than we talked, but... Mark's better at keeping things succinct than we are, I guess. But Mark Boyle and Slick Leonard, they sit down with a weekly conversation as well, going through Slick's history in basketball. And I think we just got through the ABA championships this week, so that's a good listen as well. And you can listen to that one right here where you listen to the Sideline Guys podcast. For Jeremiah Johnson and Mark Boyle, I'm Pat Boylan. We'll talk to you next week.